Good morning. We apologize for being somewhat late, but our pre-oral argument conference ran a little longer. The 09AP1643CR, State versus William Dinkins Sr., has the privilege of being the first case of this term. So we're going to hear first from James M. Frymuth, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin. Mr. Frymuth.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. I am Assistant Attorney General James Frymuth, representing the state of Wisconsin as petitioner in this criminal case. Defendant William Dinkins Sr. stands convicted of violating Wisconsin's sex offender registration law by failing to provide the Department of Corrections with the address at which he would be residing at least 10 days before his release from prison on a conviction of first-degree sexual assault of a child. The Court of Appeals reversed the registration law conviction, ostensibly for lack of sufficient proof. The state respectfully asks this court to reinstate Mr. Dinkins' conviction, and in doing so to reach the following three conclusions. First, a violation of what I call the address reporting requirement does not require the state to prove that the sex offender had, in the words of the Court of Appeals, quote, an address at which he could have reasonably predicted he would have been able to reside for an extended period of time, unquote. As I hope to address shortly, such a requirement is not practical or workable. Second, the registration law correctly assumes that because everyone has to live and sleep somewhere in the community, every sex offender is inherently capable of providing such information to DOC, whether by reference to an actual or a neighboring street address. Interpreted this way, the registration law comports with due process. And third, in Mr. Dinkins' case, the state adduced sufficient evidence of all three essential elements of the crime of failing to comply with the address reporting requirement. That is, as a convicted sex offender, he knew he had to provide address information to DOC no later than 10 days before his release from prison, and that he failed to do so. As a threshold matter, the words address and residing in the registration law appear to be ambiguous as applied to a sexual offender who claims to be transient or homeless. The Court of Appeals focused on the word reside in that provision of the statute, and using standard dictionary definitions came up with the definition, quote, live in a location for an extended period of time. Other dictionaries, however, including legal dictionaries, define reside much more broadly to mean, for example, quote, any place of abode or dwelling place, however temporary it may be, unquote. That's Ballantyne's Law Dictionary. Black's Law Dictionary defines residence in part as, quote, the place where one actually lives as distinguished from a domicile. Residence usually just means bodily presence as an inhabitant in a given place, unquote. Also, the word address.
Those are the definitions you want for reside.
Right. I think
temporary. Well, actually lives.
Correct.
So park bench, okay?
Yes.
Great outside the state capitol, okay?
Yes. Any location that's reportable to the Department of Corrections.
Does the Department of Corrections have to find housing for someone who's released? For Mr. Is it Dinkins? Yes.
Right. Not when they're completely off paper, so to speak.
Are they off paper? Is he off paper?
I understand it, yes.
So he was just released, not as a 980, not parole, not extended provision, not probation, not anything. He's free as a bird, but he has to register.
Right. Actually, what happened in his case, because he did not report his address before his release from prison within the 10 days, he was never actually released into the community. What happened? Go ahead.
What kind of a sentence was he serving? That was right in that time frame when there was pre-TIS, TIS 1, TIS 2. You know, back in 99, as I recall, sometimes you'd have to sentence people on two different kinds of of sentencing structures.
Right. You know, I think
so. He wasn't a parole. He wasn't on parole.
He was old. He was before Truth in Sentencing, but he was. He might have been revoked from parole at one point, but he was serving to his maximum discharge date. So he had to serve his entire term. And that was going to expire, I think, July 20th of 2008 is the year. Okay. So what happened was DOC, when he turns in this form without the address, DOC referred it to the Dodge County District Attorney, who then issued a complaint. He was not then released into the community. He was taken to jail. And after that court trial, then he sentenced, and he was placed on probation of 30 months. At that point, perhaps ironically, Department of Corrections assisted in finding him a residence, and as far as I understand, he now has completed that term of probation.
So, in answer to my question, did the DOC have to help him or get residence for him?
Not as far as I understand it.
Did any other department or agency of the government have to find it? So he's in prison. He's in prison.
Correct.
And 10 days before he's released, the statute says you got to get an address.
That's correct.
So it's hard enough to find an apartment or home when you're out, but he's got to find it while he's in prison without help.
Sure.
Okay.
And
you think that's fair and reasonable, due process?
Correct.
But he could have just said, I'm going to live wherever I can find a good place, or any place in Madison where I can put down my bags.
I think it's an open question as to what would have been satisfactory if you would have described the location, although, in this case, he did nothing. But I think part of the problem, and the knotty problem with this situation is...
It is a knotty problem.
It is. Yes, and that's why I come to the conclusion that I think the best answer, rather than to get in, well, when he's in prison, did my social worker do enough for me? Did my parole officer do enough for me? Did I do enough in trying to find a place? What if I had, as he did, asked my daughter, and she said no? Is that, you get into this, well, what is going to be good enough then to satisfy that requirement? Conversely, if this is an element that the state must prove, all the state theoretically would have to do is say, well, here's a homeless shelter that we found, that you could have found, that would have accepted you. Therefore, we proved that because you didn't do that, you didn't satisfy that what's called an actual knowledge element of the statute. And I think to avoid that, the only way you can do this is to say everybody is subject to that requirement. Now, you can debate about what is going to be sufficient as to implementing that. As I sent to the court, I just discovered, unfortunately, only recently, the administrative directive that suggests weekly reporting, for example, to police station. But I don't think either that directive or anything like that is necessary to make the statute as it reads constitutional. In other words, the address requirement is what it is in the statute. It is satisfactory. It can be complied with by everybody. Mr. Dinkins did not do it.
Counsel, I'm curious to know about something that was mentioned sort of on the periphery in the record and in the briefs, but has a more prominent role in this administrative directive that was issued on or about June 14 of this year, and that is GPS monitoring. In response to prior questions, you indicated, and I think accurately so, based upon my review of this record, that Mr. Dinkins, 10 days prior to his release, the initial release from incarceration, was not going to be on any kind of supervision. I'm curious to know how GPS tracking would fit into such an absence of supervision, just as a purely practical matter, as well as if you're in a position to do it, how it fits in with this administrative directive.
Right.
I know that there might not be a lot in the record about it, but I think it would be helpful, at least to me, to know what the practical result of whatever opinion is going to be issued as a matter of this case.
Right. And I don't have, unfortunately, I can't give you a precise answer at this point, and I certainly will get back to you on that. My understanding is that for GPS monitoring, and Mr. Dinkins is a lifetime GPS registrant. He has to be on GPS lifetime. My understanding of the technology is that it requires a landline. So somebody in his position who doesn't have a phone, a landline, something has to be done. I don't know precisely what that is. There's some suggestion in this administrative directive, at least for the what's called the special bulletin people. Those are ones that are considered to be a significant risk. There is a provision suggesting that they have to report to the jail in the evening, and perhaps that is going to be the location at which that landline emanates from. How they do it for somebody who does not have a landline, I don't know the answer.
For one in Mr. Dinkins' position that is homeless, I'm curious to know what would the authority be for the department to say, okay, you don't have a street address, and telling us that you're going to live somewhere in Madison isn't going to do it. You are therefore required to check in at one of the precincts of the Madison Police Departments every night or every other night. What is that authority?
I think in 301.45, I think it's sub 2, but there's a, in the same stat or same subsection that we're dealing with the address requirement, there's a subdivision F, I believe it is. F is in Frymuth. And in that subdivision, it allows or authorizes DOC to come up with additional requirements. And I think that's where, in order to help monitor. And I think that's where this would stem from. Now, there's also provision in 301.45 that directs DOC to come up with rules to implement this. Unfortunately, until I discovered this, I didn't find any such rules. Nothing in the administrative code that addresses this. This is all I know about from them.
Thank you.
Mr. Frymuth, I don't quite understand what it is you expected Mr. Dinkins to report under the statute. Kind of put yourself in his position. How should he have filled out that form?
I think he had to decide, well, when I get out of prison here, if I can't stay with my daughter, I have to go somewhere. And I think it's fair that even though he hasn't had the opportunity to be in the community and look around, he could have investigated. He could have, in fact, chose not to use the assistance of the social worker to try to identify a location. I think he could have reasonably said, I'm going to be in this community, I'm going to go to this park, this homeless shelter, this area of the city, and then describe that. I think the difficult part here is the advance notice part, and I agree that that makes it harder, but I don't think it makes it unfair necessarily or impossible. The federal statute that I quote at page 18 and 19 of the brief, if I may just reiterate that quote, I think describes what is necessary, I think, for somebody in his position. That is, quote, information about a certain part of a city, that is the sex offender's habitual locale, or in this case would be, a park or spot on the street, or a number of such places, where the sex offender stations himself during the day or sleeps at night, shelters among which the sex offender circulates, or places in public buildings, restaurants, libraries, or other establishments that the sex offender frequents. That's what the federal, that's the U.S. Department of Justice guidelines to implement the federal registration law.
Well, my recollection is that this is a case out of Dodge County.
Right.
And it's my understanding that Mr. Dinkins came from Beaver Dam. Is there a homeless shelter in Beaver Dam?
I do not know.
I imagine there are overpasses, park benches somewhere in Beaver Dam. I mean, are you saying literally that he should identify a park bench or an overpass if there is no homeless shelter?
Yes. I think there has to be some way that he can be monitored by law enforcement at a specific location or general location, in part because, and setting aside my inability to answer the question of how you apply the GPS here, but GPS has an inclusion zone and an exclusion zone, for example. So there are some limitations on, you know, where he can be, but again, I think that's it's not a perfect solution, but I think it's the only solution that you can come up with to address somebody who says, I don't have a place, or I'm not going to report a place. I don't think you can do this to me.
Would your answer be the same if he were going to be released on, say, December 20th rather than July 20th?
Yes, I think so. I because of the conditions and the, I still think the requirement is that he has to, under the sex offender registration law, indicate where he's going to be. And in some cases, at best, it may be descriptive, but other than what I've described, I don't know of any other way to respond to that. If you don't do that, and you have this sort of exemption, or you have this more ambiguous, for an extended period of time definition that the Court of Appeals puts into it, then you basically are encouraging somebody not to report. Mm-hmm. For example, even somebody in the community now with this decision in hand could say, okay, I'm at this residence here, I don't like being monitored, I'm just going to leave. I have 10 days in which to report where I'm going to be, but if I don't have a fixed residence, I really don't have to report under the Court of Appeals decision because I don't have a place where I'm going to be staying that language regularly or for an extended period of time. So anybody in the community now, a sex offender with this requirement, could say that I'm just going to disappear, basically.
Here's what I don't understand or what bothers me. Was he told he could say, I don't have a residence and I'm going to be in Beaver Dam and I'll be between X streets and Y streets? You don't expect him to know the federal rules.
Right.
And there's no department rules. So he leaves it, is he left it blank?
I'm sorry. No, he put it, what was written on there, and I think it was written on there by his social worker is, quote, to be determined by agent. But I agree with you that...
Well, then why didn't the agent do that? It's not his fault. It's
right.
His or her fault agent.
Absolutely. And I think his...
But he was in prison, not the agent.
Correct.
No, that makes sense.
No, I agree here that, and what's the most problematic aspect of... The two things that I find most problematic are the advance reporting, the difficulty with that. But the other is there was no rule, no guidance as to how to address somebody who said, I don't have an address.
Yeah. Counsel, when I listen to the oral argument, I hear comments about what's workable, what's going to work, and what would be a good idea. But our job, of course, isn't what's going to work or what's a good idea, but what does the statute say?
Correct.
So I want to go back to the words of the statute, because this case is all about us interpreting what those words mean. And in referring to 301.45, and I'm now on the address requirement that's under 2, I guess, sub 5 here, the registry shall contain all the following with respect to each person. 5, the address at which the person is or will be residing. So that's a focus of our inquiry. What does it mean? What does the word address mean? Now, the Court of Appeals, as I recall, kind of skirted that issue, wondering if a park bench can really have an address. Earlier this morning, I was along the trail on Lake Monona Terrace. Lots of park benches. I'm not sure there's an address for those. Unlike if it were a grate right in front of the Capitol, maybe there would be an address. But
I was just going to say, I think address broader than just saying street number, for example, 5723. Uh-huh. I'm thinking address as I quoted the federal statute, and some state statutes are read the same way, that is, a description of where the person, for lack of a better term, hangs out.
Uh-huh. Could it, provide a number, and I would have been really impressed.
That's right. It could mean that, but it doesn't say that. It says address. When I say, what's your address,
right.
Usually there's a street number.
And that's why I agree. I think it's ambiguous as to...
The next word, though, I want to touch upon is the word residing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, from the very onset of this oral argument, you defined the word residing, and you took issue with the Court of Appeals' definition of the word residing. Of course, the statute itself doesn't define reside, and so we revert, as did the Court of Appeals, to what is the normal and customary definition. That's an analytical framework that we all use. But I noted that the Court of Appeals, in looking at what is the ordinary or customary definition, I don't know if I have that exact wording, but that's close to...
Paragraph 19 and 20, I think, of the Court of Appeals decision.
Thank you. Yes, starting with 18, that's right. And so you're absolutely right. So we give it its ordinary and accepted meaning. And then they cite Webster and they cite Funk and Wagnall for what they call the ordinary and accepted meaning. The two dictionaries that you cite are legal dictionaries. And I've often wondered this in terms of not only this case, but analysis in and of itself, that when we take this, if we don't have it defined in the statute, then we give it its ordinary meaning. Does the ordinary meaning mean we revert to law dictionaries? It seems to me that's rather extraordinary, and that's not the route to go. The ordinary meaning is, to me, more appropriately one that's used by the ordinary person. Can you respond?
Sure. I think when you're defining terms in a statute that aren't defined, you have to look at the context in which they're being used. And I think here, at least, the definition of reside in the context of sex offender reporting has to be given a meaning that encompasses those types of individuals, including people like Mr. Dinkins or anybody in the community who says, I don't have a nice street address to give you. I'm going to be around here, or I'm going to be around there. And so I think when you talk about how are we going to define reside in the statute, you have to look, I think, at context. And that's where I think this... If you take the dictionary definition that they seized on, to live in a location for an extended period of time, you're going to exclude a large number of individuals who just can't fit that definition. Not only that, but then you have to define the words within that definition. The word extended, for example, well, what does that mean? A week? A month? How long is that going to be?
But your definition has the same impediment. You have temporary. How long is temporary?
Right. But, I think the only way that I could see out of this conundrum is the argument that I advanced, and that is to say it applies to everybody. And we have to come up with a way for somebody who doesn't meet our normal definition of living in a place in an extended period, or I'll call it a fixed residence, some way to capture those people within the statute. Now, admittedly, the statute didn't really think about that, it appears, or it's not specifically addressed. But the only way that I see to do that fairly and comprehensively is to have address mean apply to everybody. And that means finding out a way to have a transient or a homeless sex offender be able to comply with that statute.
So I hear the state saying that address where you reside means you have to fill in a geographical place or area.
Correct.
That's it.
Correct.
Simple.
Correct.
That still doesn't necessarily mean that Mr. Dinkins violated the statute, because who would know that's what the definition of address where you reside. For a moment there, I thought, well, you could get a post office box.
Correct.
say I reside near the post office box.
Would that be okay? I think so. It's a place where you receive mail.
It's a little cramped to reside in a post office box.
I think maybe it probably needs more than just where I can get mail. It's where I'm going to be so that they can locate them.
In and around downtown post office where I'll have a box for $5 or $10, whatever it costs, even though I don't necessarily have $10 now.
Like I said earlier, I think the real unfairness, if there is any here, is nobody really told Mr. Dinkins what to do when he was saying, I don't have a place. He's
already served his term.
For the sex offender violation?
Oh, for this violation.
He was coming out of prison on maximum discharge, yes.
I know. But he was convicted of this offense,
Right? Sex offender crime, yes.
Convicted of failing to register appropriately.
Correct.
All right. Where is he as a result of that? Has he served that? Is he done with it?
Yes, I believe.
Is this moot as to him?
I believe he has served his term. It's not moot in the sense that he still has that felony conviction on his record.
Yes, I understand that.
It does, yes.
So you think it's fair to keep that conviction on his record?
I think under the circumstances it is, because I don't think it was that hard for anybody to just say, I'm going to describe where I'm going to be, even if I'm not told that. And he just decided, I'm not going to do anything. I guess that's the best answer I can give you. Mm-hmm. The record suggests here that he was somewhat resistant to complying, but I hesitate to get into that, because then we get into, well, how much do you have to really do to comply to look for a place?
Right.
And
we don't want to punish him for being resistant.
That's right.
Right? Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Freimuth. I see my time's up. Thank you.
You'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thanks.
Representing Mr. Dinkins, Stephen D. Phillips, Assistant State Public Defender. Morning.
Good morning. Steve Phillips for Mr. Dinkins. A fundamental principle is at stake in this case, a principle which even the state has conceded at page 36 of its brief, and that is that one cannot be convicted of a crime, much less a serious felony, if one fails to report a fact of which he has no knowledge. And that's why I would like to focus on the requirement in the statute that requires that Mr. Dinkins knowingly failed to provide the information that was required of him. The principle that I just spoke of is based in common sense, it's based in logic, and it's rooted in fundamental principles of fundamental fairness and substantive due process. And I think it's reflected in the statute because the legislature has required that this violation be knowing. The only reasonable way to construe the statute is that it requires the state to prove that Mr. Dinkins knew at the time that he was required to report the address that he was required to report and that he failed to provide it. And because the state could not satisfy that requirement, could not prove that element, Mr. Dinkins' conviction should be reversed.
Yeah, here, the state says that he knew he was going to go somewhere. And then the state says all he had to do was say Beaver Dam between blocks A through Z. And he knew that. You have to know something, right?
Well, you know that you will end up somewhere, but that does not mean that you know 10 days in advance exactly where you're going to end up. And Mr. Freimuth claims that someone inherently knows that, and I disagree with that wholeheartedly. I don't think anyone in Mr. Dinkins' position would inherently have known where he would end up, the address at which he would reside, which is what the legislature requires.
Would you expect him to know what community he's going to? in 10 days?
Perhaps.
He may change his mind.
Perhaps. In fact, I'm not sure that Beaver Dam was the community that he wanted to go to.
Okay. He was another community.
He was just transferred from the Oshkosh Correctional Institution to Dodge County because that's where his previous conviction had been. So that's where they charged him for failing to report this information.
Counsel, what I hear you saying then is the exact opposite of what Mr. Freimuth just said. You're saying his state of mind, what he did to find a place, whether he knowingly violated this, is really the crux of the issue. That what he did or didn't do is determinative of whether he knowingly violated, right?
Yes.
So what you're really asking us to do is reverse the trial, saying there is no evidence at trial that could support the conviction because there was no evidence that he shirked that responsibility.
Exactly. And in fact, I think the trial judge, this was a bench trial on stipulated facts, actually the facts that were reduced at the preliminary hearing. And the trial judge, right before the bench trial, had issued an order disposing of some pretrial motions in which the judge specifically found that Mr. Denkins had made an effort to locate housing, but that he was unable to do so. So, I think it's undisputed that Mr. Denkins in this situation did not know where he was going to reside. And, you know, I would like to address, I guess, Justice Prosser's question about, well, what could he have done? And Mr. Freimuth talks generally and in the abstract about homeless offenders and their ability to identify their future residences. But we don't get any specifics as to what he should have done. We know that his relatives, he was trying to live with his relatives, but they didn't want him. A hotel or motel, realistically, here's a person who has just been in prison for 10 years, has no cash, no credit cards, no credit history, no positive history. Certainly that was out. Nobody's going to rent him a hotel sight unseen. Could he have gone to a homeless shelter? Well, first of all, some homeless shelters don't even accept sex offenders. Is there a registry of homeless shelters that was provided to him? If so, that certainly isn't in the record. Is there a registry of available park benches? That Mr. Denkins could have said, well, I think I like this park bench. It's in a scenic location. 10 days in advance, he would not have known which park bench would be available to him. Would it be occupied when he got there? Would the cops roust him from trying to sleep there? Would there be some regulation or ordinance that forbid him from that particular location? I looked up on the DOC registry recently, or website, I should say. They maintain a list of ordinances that restrict where sex offenders can live or be. And there's 116 municipalities that have ordinances of this type. For a person in Mr. Dinkins' situation, trying to determine in advance where he would end up was nearly impossible. And that's, you know, one of the critical factors in this case that Mr. Freimuth has acknowledged that distinguishes this case from many of the published cases across the country. Excuse me. This is not a situation where Mr. Dinkins was out in the community and was sleeping on a park bench or over a heating grate or something, and he was simply refusing to report where he had been residing or saying, well, you know, I don't think what I have is a residence, so I just won't register it. I won't tell them where I am. This is a situation where he had to decide before even getting released from prison where he was going to be, and he was going to have to figure out which park bench, which heating grate, which freeway underpass he would be able to, quote, reside at.
Counselor, if we focus back on the terms address
and residing that are in the statute. And I guess it's A5, or maybe it's, I don't know, the statutes are so complicated. I think you know what I'm referring to, address or residing. If those terms are subject to varying interpretations and become ambiguous, I think Mr. Frymuth said he thought that address could be construed as being ambiguous. Can Mr. Dinkins be convicted of a statute that is ambiguous?
Well, I think there's certainly a notice problem when those terms are ambiguous. He makes reference to the federal statute, for example, which provides all kinds of other things besides the typical residence that one may report to the authorities. You know, if Wisconsin had adopted that, this would be a much different case. What we have here is the simple terms of reside and address that are undefined, and I think the court has to use the ordinary definition of those terms until the legislature changes the law.
And the DOC regs that Mr. Frymuth provided us with and you a copy of on August 30th assist in the interpretation of that statute if we were to conclude it was ambiguous.
Well, I don't think you could apply that to Mr. Dinkins' case.
May well be, but in the future, how would they affect the statute, if you have a view on that?
I think the DOC directive is a good start towards clarifying how a person in his situation could possibly comply with the statute. And I've pointed out in my brief, there are a number of legislatures across the country that have tackled this problem and have come up with comprehensive schemes for homeless persons to register. And usually what it involves is three different things, which I think will ensure public safety. One, you require greater frequency of reporting. Two, you require the person to report in person so that they're not just calling from wherever. I noticed that the DOC directive doesn't even require reporting in person. And three, you require greater detail in the reporting requirements, not just as a residence, but to include such things as where the person is eating, sleeping, loitering, panhandling, whatever they're doing, so that the authorities have more of an idea of exactly where the person will be. And actually, I think, Mr. Frymuth's position actually makes the community less safe, because what he would say in this situation is that Mr. Dinkins should have just listed a park bench, and that would have been sufficient. But then, if you think about it, under the statute, he gets to this park bench on the first day, and what happens? It's occupied, or he can't stay there, or whatever. And so then under the statute, he has 10 days to inform the authorities that he's changed his residence. And in that 10 days, they won't know where he is.
Counsel, one piece of the factual background in this matter, which neither attorney has discussed so far, is the fact that there appears to be evidence in the record in the form of a transcript of a Ms. Smith, a social worker assigned to help Mr. Dinkins. And I read the transcript again this morning, and it does indicate that she first testified at page 30 of her transcript, I offered twice to help him find a place, and he rejected my offer. Then on the next page, she kind of backs away from it. I don't remember how many times I offered to help, but I did check in with him on a weekly basis to see if he had found a place. And so should that express rejection of the offer of assistance to find an address play any part of any role in our consideration of this matter?
No, because I think the record, for one thing, is a little more unsettled on that point, because I recall the testimony that you're speaking of, and I think on the next page she says, well, the next week he did come into my office.
Right.
And he was seeking my help. It's unclear what help exactly she was offering. I mean, she didn't have any homeless shelter to suggest to him. Or
it's not apparent, and I think that's one of the things we're all sort of wrestling here on a very practical level. It's not apparent that the DOC has any resources under these particular circumstances.
Exactly. The resources exist. And keep in mind that the vast majority of people that are getting released from prison won't be facing this problem because they'll be on supervision. And as the DOC directive points out, if the person is on supervision, they can make use of DOC resources to find them a place. So if Mr. Dinkins were on parole and had said, well, I don't have any place to live, they would have found a place for him to live before releasing him from prison. That's what makes this case, you know, relatively unique in that regard.
Counsel, there's some discussion as to the defendant, Mr. Dinkins' response, whether or not he was compliant or attempted to be compliant, or if he resisted providing this information. Your opposing counsel at the close of his comments this morning talked about resistance. What, if anything, are we to do with what appears to be a circuit court finding? The Court of Appeals makes reference to it in paragraph 7 of its opinion and also footnote 2. And it states the circuit court later found that Dinkins had, quote, attempted to comply with the address reporting requirement of the statute, but he'd been unable to find housing for himself upon release. Footnote 2 indicates at oral argument the state tentatively suggested that this finding was clearly erroneous. To the extent that the state challenges the court's finding, we conclude it is not clearly erroneous. Is this indeed a finding of the circuit court, as the Court of Appeals indicates in paragraph 7? And if so, is there anything in the record that you think could support it being clearly erroneous, or that you can think of would support it?
It is a finding, and it's the finding that I was referring to earlier that in the trial court's discussion or decision on the motion to dismiss, and I think this court is bound by that finding, and I don't think there is evidence in the record that would suggest that it's clearly erroneous. And, you know, we argued this case in the Court of Appeals. We've written briefs. We're arguing it again, and I've yet to hear Mr. Frymuth suggest specifically what Mr. Dinkins could have done to locate housing. I think under the situation that he was presented with, he was just one of those persons that did not have housing and did not know where he would reside.
Counsel, I assume you agree that the point of registering and giving the address of the residence is so that the place of residing fits within the statutory and ordinance requirements, and that law enforcement can find them if they need them, right?
Exactly.
All right. And that seems to be the objective or an objective of that, and it seems to be a reasonable objective that is related to a state interest, right?
Right.
So what do we do when there is no housing or there is no specific, as we would see it, a place of residence with a street address? How do you make the statute work? I mean, that's the point of it being here, isn't it?
Yes.
That we don't say, oh, you can just write in anything at all and you can get away with that.
Right.
Because the goal is to have a particular address.
Yeah, if you're speaking about the current statute, there is a mechanism in the statute, and Mr. Frymuth referred to it in subsection 2F, which allows the department to require the individual who has not provided some fact, as he's required to do, require that individual to report to the law enforcement authorities and provide that information. And what I've suggested in my brief is that The department in this situation could have told Mr. Dinkins, okay, you don't know what your residence is. When you get released, you go to the police station in Beaver Dam or Madison or wherever they chose, and you report there, and you tell them where you're going to be living. And if you can't tell them that, then you can at least tell them where you are right now and what you plan for the next few hours. And the law enforcement authorities can say, okay, come back tomorrow and tell us where you ended up sleeping. And they can keep doing that. And, you know, that's already in the statute. Now, is that a perfect solution? No. But, you know, other legislatures have come up with much more comprehensive schemes for allowing people to simply report that they are homeless. And then once they've done that, that triggers enhanced reporting requirements and protects the community safety in that respect by requiring those people to report more regularly and in more detail. That, I think, is a much better answer to the problem than what Mr. Frymuth suggests.
So, in other words, you don't favor just having the report say, I am homeless and I'll be within the following 10-block area.
Do I favor that?
Do you think that's an intelligent interpretation of the statute to fit the objectives of the legislature? I mean, that's what we're doing in interpreting a statute. You can say, yes, it'll work. Or you can say, no, it's not an objective. For two reasons. One, he can't do it because he doesn't really know. Or two, that doesn't fill the objective.
Yeah,
and that the legislature in 2F provided an alternative. If you don't have an address and you can't give an address, meaning a physical place, then what you have to do is report to the law enforcement, and they'll take over from there, and that we shouldn't do anything else but what the legislature said.
Right. I don't think that...
So what's your response?
For him to report that I will be in a 10-block area of the city of Madison, I don't believe that would comply with the statute in its current form.
What about a 1-block area?
1-block area still does not identify a residence, still does not provide an address. I mean, we're getting closer, but, you know, as I have pointed out already, you know, it was difficult for Mr. Dinkins to know where that 1-block area would be. If he showed up and that area wasn't available to him, then he's reported, you know, something which is useless to the authorities in monitoring his location.
Well, then I hear you saying the legislature provided an alternative. If you don't have a residence, this is what you do.
Yes.
And that's what you think the court should say.
Yes. And of course, if that is not deemed sufficient protection of the community, the court should certainly suggest to the legislature that it adopt a comprehensive scheme like other legislatures have done, something similar to the framework of the DOC directive. The sky won't fall if somebody is simply registering as homeless but then reporting on a regular basis to the authorities, calling them up saying, here's where I am, here's where I eat, here's where I sleep, here's where I go to the library, whatever. I mean, I think we have to keep in mind that even the registration system, in its current form, wasn't designed to monitor the presence, the actual location of a registrant 24/7. That can't be done short of putting somebody in prison and locking them up. Even if they provide the address for a residence, you don't know that they're going to be at the residence all day. You don't know that they're going to be there every day.
Counselor, I want to get back to your suggestion under 2F that if all the information required by 2A and address and residence is, or residing, I guess, other words, are two of those things. So if I understand your argument, you're saying under F, 2F, the department may require a person and then to provide any information required under paragraph A that the person has not provided. Is that what you're relying on, those words?
Yes.
Okay. If the department may do that, does the department have, I mean, it says may in the statute, but here we've got a prosecution without an activity by the department giving him some alternative, correct?
Yes.
How does all that fit together in a way that reasonably comports with the objective of the statute as set out by the Chief Justice and agreed to, I think, by everyone?
Well, I think that the person will, you know, in Mr. Dinkins' situation, will say, I can't find any place to live. That will be noted in the database. The department will then tell the person, okay, show up at the police department on the next day and continue showing up and continue telling us, you know, where did you sleep last night? Where have you been eating? Whatever. And they can require that information.
And that was not given as an option to him,
no,
in this case,
was not.
Correct?
No.
Counsel, when the Chief Justice outlined what she believed the objectives of the statute were, she indicated things like so law enforcement can find him, that sort of thing. When I read that chapter in its entirety, there's a lot more than that. The public has the right to know who's living down the road from them. And the department has the requirement to put a red dot or whatever on the computer and provide internet access and other things so that the public knows, not just law enforcement knowing where to find the person. And it seems, anyway, that the legislature decided to make that a priority when it required certain things of people who have been convicted of sex offenses who are getting out of prison. And how does that relate to our discussion of what's fair for Mr. Dinkins? Because it also needs to be fair for the public. So help me out with that, because right now the focus has been on his inability to provide an address and what should be done to make sure that he's treated fairly. Let's also address what should be done to make sure the public has the information that is set forth and the requirements can be followed as set forth in that chapter.
Well, I certainly think that providing the address of some random park bench, for example, which is the suggestion Mr. Frymuth has made, or some heating grate, is not going to protect the public. What protects the public to a far greater extent is what I've suggested currently exists under paragraph 2F, which is you don't have a specific residence, but you know where the person is. Providing the park bench, when all that is the individual's guess as to where he might end up, is not going to protect the public, particularly since once he gets there and discovers that he can't stay there anymore or chooses to go somewhere else, he then has 10 days during which to report the change to the department.
That would happen if you left to go to a residence, though, and had an actual address and then found out you couldn't be there for some reason. You'd have 10 days. So that's not
going to in that 10-day period, the public won't know where you are. And you know, that's the problem with the suggestion that you just take a stab at where you might end up.
So people coming in, for example, under the federal requirements or under other states where they've been convicted of a sex offense, if they just say, I'm homeless, I don't know where I'm going to live in this state, they can just come into Wisconsin and stay here and they won't be. It's almost as if people who actually have an address then are punished more than people who
well,
don't.
Well, you know, I don't think that first of all, the conditions of being homeless are miserable enough that people will want to claim I'm homeless just to avoid the homeless registration, particularly if, as I suggest, you can require enhanced reporting requirements, which will make it inconvenient for them to maintain that claim that they're homeless. That's number one. Number two, I don't think it's going to discourage people from seeking a residence, people like Mr. Dinkins, to have this homeless, you know, claim available to them. Because
we can't make the homeless exemption. The legislature has to
right.
do that. So, and, I mean, that's not really within our scope.
And I want to emphasize that, you know, and I think I've emphasized this in my brief, that I'm not advocating an exemption for homeless people, particularly since all homeless persons are not similarly situated. Some people can, you know, they may be in a homeless shelter. They can report the address of the homeless shelter. I don't have any problem with reporting where you have been. It's the particular situation that Mr. Dinkins faced here of trying to predict where he would be once he got out of prison. And that's what made it impossible for him to comply with the statute.
Counselor, I want to go back again to 2F. Is that really an option to reporting? I mean, I think perhaps I too strongly construed your argument, you know, as I look at the statute again and again. It does say that they can be required to report any information required under Parent A that has not been previously reported. But if what he's going to do is come in and say, well, I'm going to be on so-and-so park bench, well, then we're just pretty much back to Mr. Frymuth's argument.
Right. I mean, it's not a great solution. It's not a perfect solution. But we're stuck with the statute that we have, unfortunately, until the legislature changes it. And I think that there are other state legislatures across the country that have addressed this problem in a more comprehensive way that would provide an excellent example for the legislature to follow. But, you know, in the meantime, we have to consider what Mr. Dinkins was facing under this statute. And I think that is an alternative that the department had available to them at the time.
You keep saying that until the legislature changes it. Do you think that the Department of Corrections has no authority to interpret and apply various techniques?
That's a good question. I guess they have rulemaking authority. I'm not sure that the directive complies with rulemaking authority.
This may not have complied with rulemaking. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Also, it's disseminated to the staff. It doesn't say you give it to the inmates. So, I mean, you got notice problems. But aside from that, by repeating reference only to the legislature, you're not saying it's impossible for the department to do rulemaking according to the statutes, or are you?
No.
Okay.
No.
All right. I don't follow the sex registry. So do they update it? So if I were a sex offender and I reported today that I've changed my residence, would they put it on the web immediately?
I don't know how immediately, but that's, you know, one of the problems that you have with registering temporary places like park benches and so forth. You can end up clogging the system. If a homeless person goes to a park bench one day, goes to a heating grate the next day, and goes to a freeway underpass the third day, under the statute, under the state's interpretation, it would require him to report to DOC with his change of residence every day. And of course, he has a 10-day grace period. So if he reports the first change of residence on day 10, and he's already moved from the second residence to a third location, the information that would be provided would be useless, and it would clog the whole system with useless information.
Unless there are other questions, Justice Prosser.
Are there any suggestions for... Are you happy with the Court of Appeals decision exactly as written?
Unfortunately, I'm not happy with it, but not because I disagree with anything that the Court of Appeals said. I think it's a reasonable attempt to make sense of the statute that, frankly, does not expressly account for homeless offenders. And I think the definitions that they employ of residence and address comport with what everybody understands to be a residence. You know, you have to be able to distinguish between, you know, going to, if I go camping for a night, or I go to Milwaukee and stay overnight in a hotel one night, I haven't changed my residence. You have to be able to distinguish between situations like that and you know, a true residence. And I think the Court of Appeals decision is good at doing that. Now, my disagreement with it, I guess, is I think it goes farther than it had to resolve this case. And the reason I say that is because I don't think it matters a bit how one defines residence. Even if you define residence as broadly as Mr. Frymuth would, to include park benches and heating grates, the simple matter of fact in this case is that Mr. Dinkins did not know in advance which park bench, which heating grate, which underpass he would be allowed to, quote, reside in once he got out. That's the critical factor that you know, the Court of Appeals referred to that and said that, you know, it was all the more difficult for Mr. Dinkins to list his residence because of this. But really, I don't know that it was necessary to go down the road of what residence and address mean in this particular context.
Well, let me follow up on that. That certainly has some appeal to me, but is it creating an additional element of the offense?
No, I don't. You mean the Court of Appeals decision? Well,
what you're saying, what you're arguing.
Yeah.
I mean, the jury instructions, as I understand, are the knowingly applies to whether the offender knows he has to report some information. And I think what you're arguing is that knowingly applies to the information, all the information. And it would seem to me you can't just say that information is I'm going to live in a particular or reside in a particular place. It's everything in that form once you get that definition.
Right. Which is one of the things I pointed out. It also says that you must list where you are or will be employed. And, you know, some people won't have employment when they get out of prison, and yet the statute says if you don't list it, you can be convicted. Well, Mr. Dinkins didn't list his residence because he didn't have a residence any more than he had employment. And you know, that's why I focus on the term knowingly, and I think the jury instructions committee, quite honestly, like the legislature, probably didn't think of this scenario, that someone wouldn't know the information that they're required to provide. I mean, it's an unusual situation.
Aren't you really asking, aren't you putting a burden on the state to prove that the defendant didn't know a whole list of things or anything
he didn't list? Yes, I am putting that burden on them, but, you know, there are lots of criminal statutes that place the burden on the state to prove the defendant's knowledge. And this is no more difficult than any of those other cases. You know, one of the situations that I can think of is the operating after revocation. You must know that you've been revoked in order to be convicted of operating after revocation. It's a simple thing. And the same principle applies here. You can't require someone to report a fact of which they have no knowledge and then convict them of a serious felony if they don't report that fact. There are a number of ways the state can prove knowledge. They can prove it, you know, circumstantially. They can prove it through the defendant's own admissions. They can prove it by doing a little investigation and finding out, you know, maybe there was a relative who told them, you know, come on over. You can, as soon as you get released from prison, you can stay with me. And, you know, with the GPS technology, they will know where the person is. If it shows up that he's been staying at the same place for a week and he claimed that he had no residence at all, I think that would be pretty easy proof that he violated the statute. So I don't see this as any more difficult for the state to prove knowledge in this situation than in any other.
Any other questions? If not, thank you, Mr. Phillips. Mr. Frymuth, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Taking the last point first, I think there is a problem with interpreting the statute as including what I call an actual knowledge element, knowledge of the address. It's not like typical knowledge elements where you have behavior, or you have, for example, knowledge in an obstruction case, knowledge that this is a police officer acting in the performance of his duty. In an OAR case, well, it may be knowledge of the defendant to know his driving record. That is provable. That information is available to the state through record keeping as well. Here, we're talking about something peculiar. And this is a hard word for me to say, peculiarly in the knowledge of the defendant, that is, where he or she is going to go live in the community. If you're going to recognize some kind of, for lack of a better term, I guess, affirmative, it doesn't fit as an element here. If you're going to say that we're not going to have apply this law, whether you call it an exemption or whatever, if you're going to make it an affirmative defense, it's got to be an affirmative defense with a burden on the defendant to prove somehow that he or she absolutely had no way of knowing where he or she was going to be in the community. I think the statute, at least as a starting point, and this is obviously a knotty problem. We've got a variety of state statutes on this subject. I think as a starting point, the statute as written, the word address, ambiguous as it may be, at least is sufficiently precise to say to somebody, you got to tell us where you're going to be. Now, even if it's a park bench, even if it's descriptive in some sense, and that may not be the best way to keep track of somebody and to effectuate the goals of law enforcement monitoring and protecting of victims and so forth, it's a starting point.
Counsel, that argument, though, seems at odds with the directive that you supplied us. And that's a problem for you, but you're so talented, you're probably going to show me how you can solve that problem. The problem is you want us to define this address and this residency as temporary. The park bench and the grate are the examples that we've used during the course of this oral argument and in the briefs. But this Department of Corrections directive says the purpose of this directive is, number one, to define what we mean by residence, and number two, to outline a procedure of how to handle homeless folks. And residence, they define the place where one actually lives as distinguished from a place or temporary lodging. Their very definition of residence, one of two, for this directive, is at odds with what you are arguing. How do you deal with that?
Well, I think the directive is a response to the Court of Appeals decision. It was, I don't want to say promulgated because it wasn't really a rulemaking, but it was drafted and issued in response to that, assuming the law is going to stay that way. So I would suggest that if you look at various parts of it, it is not necessarily... accurate, I guess, with respect to the existing law, nor can it trump the statute. I think it's an attempt to, to respond to Dinkins, first of all, but also to interpret and apply the statute.
It's their attempt. It's their attempt to interpret what residence means. That's what they said the purpose of this directive is.
Right.
And their definition is different than yours. Maybe not better or worse, but certainly underscores that, in my mind, that who knows what it means.
Right. I mean, I think there is a question of what it means. But I also think it's not a question that is so, that it's so unfair to somebody in Mr. Dinkins' position to not know that he had to put down something as to where he expected he was going to be in the community. He didn't do that. I think to actually effectuate after the fact, and one point that I sorely apologize for, and that is I think part of this has to do with the initial GPS monitoring aspect of it, and that's something I will report back to the court on. But I think that's in part why you need a starting point so that these individuals can have a beginning monitoring. I agree with Mr. Phillips that the way the statute reads thereafter is that you've got this sort of 10-day grace period when you're going to move around, or in fact there's a verification provision in sub 2G that the department sends a notice to this person. So they have to have some way of getting in touch with them. But there's a lag time built in, so there's nothing really perfect here. I mean, this is an attempt, at least, to try to balance the right of a defendant who's no longer under supervision, no longer under the control of the department, to have some right in the community to be where he or she is legitimately to be, but at the same time to enable the state to monitor that individual. This is kind of this hybrid between a 980 commitment and a prison sentence and being completely free. I mean, they're trying to do what they can to meet that. But I think in this case, if we're looking just at the elements of this case and the proof, and I see my time's up, I'll finish here, that the statute was sufficiently precise to give Mr. Dinkins notice that he had to put down something. He didn't do it. He's guilty of the offense.
Any questions? Thank you, Mr. Freiman.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Phillips, for your arguments today on a very interesting statutory interpretation issue, yet again involving sex offenders. We're going to take a short break to enable this camera to leave, and I think another camera and an operator will want to come in. So court will take a short break. Very short.